You're listening to the CamCam Books podcast with your hosts, Cameron and Tricia McManus. Welcome back to the CamCam Books podcast. This is season 2, episode 3, where we are finally descending into the circle of violence. In the last episode, it felt like we were just hanging out a little bit. We were pausing. I mean, that was what was happening in that canto. And I felt like it was lame. Like, I was like, oh, man, we didn't see anything exciting. And this episode, it's, I think, pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the reason that there is that breather canto is not just because Dante's like, well, I got to put it somewhere because I need to talk about the structure of hell. But it does mark a kind of threshold. From here on out, things are going to get quite dark and a fair bit disturbing. This one, less so than some of the ones that will follow, but we are reaching a different sort of sin. Well, no, we're not talking about one of the seven deadly sins anymore. Violence isn't one of those. We're kind of getting into the part of hell where you almost see souls wanting sin precisely because it's bad. They don't go quite that far. There's always some little nugget of goodness that they're after. But these are sins that the average person will not understand, will not sympathize with. There's not going to be a lot of, oh, I can totally see why you could be misled this way. This is going to be very twisted, dark spiritual fates.
All right. What's our Dante Daily?
Our Dante Daily is that sin harms the sinner most of all.
Canto 12. The place where we descend the bank we came was alpine, and from what was there, moreover, of such a kind that every eye would shun it. Such as that ruin is which in the flank smote on this side of Trent the Adige, either by earthquake or by failing stay. For from the mountain's top from which it moved unto the plain the cliff is shattered so, some path 'twould give to him who was above. Even such was the descent of that ravine, and on the border of the broken chasm, the infamy of Crete was stretched along.
So as we descend into the circle of violence, the first thing that Dante calls our attention to is that the whole area looks shattered. This ravine, there's lots of broken rocks, and it seems to have been broken apart by an earthquake. And then at the end of the description, we encounter what he calls the infamy of Crete. This is the Minotaur. So he sets us up naturally to assume, oh, the Minotaur must have caused all this violence, all this destruction. But as we're going to see, it's a bit of a bait and switch.
Who is conceived in the fictitious cow, and when he us beheld, he bit himself, even as one who anger racks within.
So for listeners who have not heard the story of the Minotaur, I'll give a brief oversimplification of it. So the Minotaur is the son of King Minos's wife. What happens is that his wife ends up mating with a bull through some evil mischief that some gods arrange. And then this son is born who's half man, half bull, hence the Minnow, Minos, Tor. Then he is locked in a labyrinth, and to appease his unending rage, he's given constant sacrifices of young men and young maidens until Theseus ends up defeating the Minotaur famously in the labyrinth with the help of really the Minotaur's sister, who loves him and gives him a ball of yarn so that he, by trailing the string as he walks, doesn't get lost in the maze and can find his way back out. Now, why does Dante open with a Minotaur? Well, usually when we have these mythological figures, they're meant to themselves stand in as a symbol of what violence is and what it does. And it's going to very much dovetail with the Dante Daily, which is that sin harms the sinner more than anyone else. So there's two things to keep in mind to understand the Minotaur's symbolism. First, he's a half-man, half-bull, but not in the way that, say, Spider-Man is half-spider and half-man. That is to say, he's, you know, more than man, and he's elevated by this animal mixing. Really, the Minotaur is not quite a man. He's bestial. He sort of lost his reason and lost his true humanity. So this is one thing that violence does to us. But the second thing, when he sees them, he bites himself. And this is going to be a key theme in this. It's not merely that, you know, what goes around comes around, and if you're violent to people, well, in hell, you're really going to get yours. What's really going on here, as we'll see, is that the souls are eternally locked into what their souls were doing when they committed violence against others. And as we discover, in the act of committing violence against others, you are damaging your own soul as well. So that biting yourself when you're angry is the image that's going to stick with us throughout this canto.
My sage towards him shouted, "Peradventure, thou thinkest that here may be the Duke of Athens, who in the world above brought death to thee. Get thee gone, beast, for this one cometh not instructed by thy sister, but he comes in order to behold your punishments."
What Virgil is saying here is that maybe you think this is Theseus again, but he's telling him, no, this is someone else coming to behold your punishment. Again, speaking to him as though he's a simpleton and can't quite have his mind work properly. As an aside, the word peradventure means maybe. If you can, try to remember that for future cantos. Our translation will use this word a fair bit throughout.
As is the bull who breaks loose at the moment in which he has received the mortal blow, who cannot walk but staggers here and there. The Minotaur beheld I do the like, and he, the wary, cried, "Run to the passage, while he wroth, till well thou shouldst descend."
Wow, what an incredible image here. So he likens what the Minotaur is doing to, I'm guessing that this is something Dante would have witnessed if he watched bullfighting. So we're imagining a bull struggling, and it's when it's received the mortal blow, the blow that's going to kill it, that's when its violence is at the highest, and when it seems to break free. This really is an image for what happens to you when you commit a mortal sin, right? You seem free. You seem finally to have broken free from the bonds. But like the bull, you're already dead. It's the very moment the violence is at the highest is also the moment in which you yourself have sustained serious mortal harm. And that's really the idea here. The irony that keeps running through this canto is that we think of the violent as people who kill others, which is, of course, quite correct. But they kill themselves in a much deeper and more lasting way because they kill their own souls as they kill others' bodies.
Thus down we took our way, o'er that discharge of stones, which oftentimes did move themselves beneath my feet from the unwonted burden. Thoughtful I went, and he said, "Thou art thinking perhaps upon this ruin which is guarded by that brute anger which just now I quenched."
So now we're going to find out what actually caused all of the destruction, the broken rocks, the sort of earthquake appearance of this area. And a couple of details have, if we've been detective-like, revealed to us that it's not what we think. Because although the Minotaur has gotten very angry, and although Virgil has says, okay, Dante, you better run, note that in the following lines, we do hear it described that the rocks start to roll and move, but note who's causing them to roll and move. Dante, not the Minotaur, which makes sense because the Minotaur is a shade. He's some sort of ghost. He's dead. He can't move rocks around. The only one who's moving rocks around here is Dante because Dante's still got his body. And that's why Virgil says, you must be wondering about things now. Perhaps you initially assume that the Minotaur here caused all of this destruction. And now you've noticed, wait, this is a shade. He can't cause this destruction. Who else did? A side point, too. This is a poetic technique that Dante, our author, is going to use throughout the Inferno. A big difference between Dante and these souls is that he's alive. And it's often underlined by him doing things like making boats sink into the water or moving rocks under his feet. It's all about Dante can still cause changes in his environment because he's not yet dead, whereas the souls in the Inferno cannot.
Now will I have thee know, the other time I here descended to the nether hell, this precipice had not yet fallen down. But truly, if I well discern a little, before his coming who the mighty spoil bore off from Diz in the supernal circle, upon all sides the deep and loathsome valley trembled so, that I thought the universe was thrilled by love, by which there are who think the world oft-times converted into chaos. And at that moment this primeval crag, both here and elsewhere, made such overthrow.
So Virgil now gives us the story, and we have to kind of read between the lines to understand what he's talking about. You might remember in a previous canto, Virgil mentioned that a sorcerer named Eurycto once conjured him to go get a soul from the bottom rung of hell and bring it so that it could impart some message to the living. So that's why Virgil knows all of these circles, even though he's only in limbo. So what he's saying is that, well, when I went down here last time to do that, this precipice, this cliff, it wasn't in this state. It actually was still kind of built up. Remember, we're in the city of Dis, so it had structures and things like that in place. So that arouses our curiosity. But I mean, the Minotaur must have been here, and the Minotaur doesn't seem to be able to break things. So what he describes really actually is the harrowing of hell. He's saying that this damage was caused when Christ came to take the souls who were waiting for the gates of heaven to open out of this place into heaven. And that makes sense of some of Virgil's statements, because he's saying, I didn't know what it was, but I thought the universe was thrilled with love. And then he alludes to other theories that others might have about what was going on. But the reason it's sort of mentioned here at all is as kind of a mirror image to the violence we're going to see, right? That there is good violence, right? There's the violence of Jesus against hell and violently taking the souls out of the clutches of demons and bringing them into heaven. Again, we note this is more poetry than theology. There's nothing in Catholic theology that suggests that Abraham and the other souls of the just were suffering while waiting for Christ to come get them, except in the suffering involved by waiting. But when you're writing a poem, yeah, it's more interesting if Christ is coming there and kicking down the door and roughing a few demons up before he takes the souls out.
But fix thine eyes below, for draweth near the river of blood within which boiling is, whoe'er by violence doth injure others. O blind cupidity, O wrath insane, that spurs us onward so in our short life, and in the eternal then so badly steeps us.
So now we're going to see the punishment of those who are violent against others. And initially it seems a little uncreative. It's just a river of boiling blood. And as we're going to see, the more violence the soul committed in life, the deeper they are in this river of blood. Now, it's a cliche image, to be sure, but it's actually cliche because it's good, because once people started using it, everyone started imitating it. I mean, Shakespeare imitated this image in Macbeth, right? We have Macbeth himself talking about how he's steeped so far in blood, so he's walking through a river, that to turn back would be as tedious as to go over. So he says, well, at this point, I might as well go all the way. But also Dante's doing more here than just saying what goes around comes around. Oh, you heard all those people and now you're getting yours. Really what he's saying here in that, especially in that statement about oh, blind cupidity, is that in our short lives, we try to inflict temporary harm on people we dislike, but not after. Not in hell, but while we do that, we inflict damage on ourselves, and that damage is experienced in eternity. What we're really seeing in the river of blood is not violent souls who are getting punished in the sense that they wish they hadn't done it because now life is so unpleasant. What we're actually seeing is these souls are eternally not repenting. They're willing every murder, every killing that they ever committed. And that's what the River of Blood is. It's why those with more victims are higher up in it, because what they're actually doing for all eternity is twisting their soul into the same shape it was when they were committing that act of murder.
I saw an ample moat, bent like a bow, as one with all the plain encompasses, conformable to what my guide had said. And between this and the embankment's foot, centaurs in file were running, armed with arrows, as in the world they used the chase to follow.
So now we see the centaurs. These are half men, half horses. So they're horses from the waist down, and they're men from the waist up, and they have bows and arrows. And as we'll see, they shoot at any soul that tries to rise further out of the River of Blood. So Dante seems to conceive of the centaurs as demons, and he's theologically sound in here, in that in general, in Catholic thought, it's thought that God allows the demons to torment the souls in hell as a sort of indirect form of justice. I mean, the demons are quite happy to torment any souls they can get their hands on, but God, in the eternal fate, will limit it to what's deserved. But I think further, the centaurs serve a couple of poetic purposes. One, this half-man, half-animal thing is a theme Dante wants to keep in our mind, that in pursuing violence as your highest good for all eternity, you're making yourself into kind of a beast. You're sort of lowering yourself. But also, I think he does give us some sense of the spiritual experience in hell, that to move your will away from one kind of pain, one kind of suffering, is only to suffer again in another way. Because the only true way out of the pain in hell is, well, would be to repent and point your will to God. And the whole point of hell is that you don't want to do that. So that is generally the fate, right? Much like the souls of the gluttonous, so many circles up, they can only warm one side of themselves. They can just choose, you know, one kind of pain or another. The same is true here. It's unpleasant for them to will their murders forever, but it's also unpleasant for them to stop murdering them forever. The centaurs are almost pangs of conscience. And we get the impression that as painful as it is to immerse yourself in that river of blood, it's even more unbearable for these souls to stop doing it for a second, because the moment they do, they begin to admit that they did something wrong and feel the remorse of conscience. And so then they're right back into the river of blood, because anything would be preferable to repentance.
Beholding us descend, each one stood still, and from the squadron three detached themselves with bows and arrows in advance selected. And from afar one cried, "Unto what torment come ye who down the hillside are descending? Tell us from there, if not, I draw the bow." My master said, "Our answer we will make to Chiron, near you there, in evil hour. That will of thine was evermore so hasty." Then touched he me and said, "This one is Nessus, who perished for the lovely Dejanira, and for himself did vengeance take."
So we're introduced to two centaurs here from Greek mythology. We'll give just a really brief simplification of who they are. So Chiron is, in the Inferno, the kind of chief of the other centaurs. He's kind of a positive figure in Greek mythology. He trains Greek heroes who are greatly admired. But as we'll see, framing him as a demon is important, because Dante's also going to kind of upend how we see those Greek heroes. Nessus is actually responsible, in a way, for the death of Hercules. So Nessus attempted to take the woman Dejanira by force, and he was killed for doing so. But then he arranged for the shirt he was wearing, which was stained with his poison blood, to be given to Hercules and to have Hercules wear it. And so the myth goes, when Hercules put on the shirt, the pain from the poison was so much that Hercules is basically chose to take his own life. So just interesting stories for us there. But what we're going to be really interested in is Chiron. Why is this kind of positive character in Greek mythology seen as so bad by Dante.
And he in the midst, who at his breast is gazing, is the great Chiron, who brought up Achilles, that other Pholus is, who was so wrathful. Thousands and thousands go about the moat, shooting with shafts whatever soul emerges out of the blood, more than his crime allots. Near we approached unto those monsters' fleet. Chiron an arrow took, and with the notch backward upon his jaws he put his beard. After he had uncovered his great mouth, he said to his companions, "Are you ware that he behind moveth whate'er he touches?" Thus are not wont to do the feet of dead men. And my good guide, who now was at his breast, where the two natures are joined together, replied, "Indeed, he lives, and thus alone me it behoves to show him the dark valley. Necessity and not delight impels us."
In what is becoming probably a familiar event, Virgil is explaining to the demons why they're here. What we want to note is that Chiron notices not just that Dante's alive, but Dante can cause changes, right? Which the dead cannot normally do. It's something to sit with us in our own spiritual reflection. Use the time you have while you're still here. And then Virgil begins to explain that we're not here simply for fun, we're here for necessity. And in the following lines, he's going to explain how Beatrice is the one who arranged this.
"Someone withdrew from singing hallelujah, who unto me committed this new office. No thief is he, nor I a thievish spirit. But by that virtue through which I am moving, my steps along this savage thoroughfare give us someone of thine to be with us. And who may show us where to pass the ford, and who may carry this one on his back, for 'tis no spirit that can walk the air."
The other thing Dante wants to remind us here about being alive is this. Just as being alive positively means you can still cause changes, it also means that you're in danger. Unlike Virgil, this river is dangerous to him precisely because he's alive, so he's going to need somebody to actually ferry him over. So they request that he ride one of the centaurs through this river of blood so that he won't be harmed by it.
"Upon his right breast Chiron wheeled about and said to Nessus, 'Turn, and do thou guide them, and warn aside if other band may meet you.' We with our faithful escort onward moved, along the brink of the vermilion boiling, wherein the boiled were uttering loud laments. People I saw within up to the eyebrows, and the great centaur said, 'Tyrants are these, who dealt in bloodshed and in pillaging. Here they lament their pitiless mischiefs. Here is Alexander and fierce Dionysius, who upon Sicily brought dolorous years.'"
Some of the tyrants described here are not going to be very familiar to us, but one who is, I want to talk about a little bit. The Alexander mentioned here is almost certainly Alexander the Great. Now, to the medievals, this was not a villainous figure. This was a figure to be admired. He almost conquered the entire world. He represented for them everything that was worth admiring about the pagan world. And even now, to some extent, that's still so, right? He's exciting to learn about. When you read about him in school, it's a great, glorious, and wonderful experience. But in this figure, we see now why Dante thought Chiron, the trainer of Achilles, should be understood as a demon. Well, why do we admire the great Greek heroes? Why do we admire Achilles? Why do we admire Alexander? Is it not because they are masters of violence, is the question he asks us? Don't we really just admire these people because they're very, very good at killing others? And if we take Catholic theology seriously, which Dante says we should, shouldn't we at some level pity these figures? Because every time they do this, they're inflicting death to their souls, not just later on, but in that very moment. And that's why these figures are up to their eyebrows in the river of blood. Remember, they're here willingly. That means that they're holding on for dear, I want to say for dear life, let's say for dear afterlife, to every single one of those kills, because otherwise they have to repent, and they absolutely refuse.
That forehead there with which the hair so black is Azolin, and the other who is blonde, Abidso, is of Esti, who, in truth, up in the world was by his stepson slain. Then turned I to the poet, and he said, "Now he be first to thee, and second I."
This remark by Virgil, "Now he be first to thee, and second I," is sort of a joke. He's saying, well, you may as well just listen to him. He's a better guide for this circle than I would ever be.
A little farther on, the center stopped, above a folk who far down as the throat seemed from that boiling stream to issue forth. A shade he showed us on one side alone, saying, "He cleft asunder in God's bosom. The heart that still upon the Thames is honored."
Who he's referring to here is King Henry II of England, who is responsible for the martyrdom of St. Thomas Becket. I won't give us a full story of his martyrdom, but he was a very popular medieval saint. If you know of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, the pilgrims are actually going to his shrine. He was actually famously and horribly in a bloody manner killed while at the altar celebrating Mass. Very popular medieval saint, such that even the Italian Dante has heard of and admires him.
Then people saw I, who from out the river lifted their heads, and also all the chest, and many among these I recognized. Thus ever more and more grew shallower that blood, so that the feet alone it covered, and there across the moat our passage was.
So what we're seeing here is that as we go through the river, some of the souls are up to their eyebrows, some of them are just up to their feet. The eternal fate really is for the souls of the violent to spend eternity not repenting of their various acts of violence. To put another way, they're sort of eternally committing them again, but not by actually harming the other person, because the other person's not there. They can't. Instead, what they're really doing eternally is harming themselves. They're just doing to their soul what they did to their soul when they committed those acts over and over again forever.
Even as thou here upon this side beholdest the boiling stream that aye diminishes, the centaur said, "I wish thee to believe that on this other more and more declines its bed until it reunites itself where it behoveth tyranny to groan. Justice divine upon this side is goading that Attila, who was scourge on earth, and Pyrrhus, and Sextus, and forever milks the tears which with the boiling it unseals."
The centaur is telling Dante here that now that we've come to a sort of shallow point in the river, if you were to continue on in the other direction, you would sort of see, once we get to the shallowest point, the river then reaches maximum depth again, and we'd see more famous, bloody tyrants. And he mentions people like Attila the Hun and Pyrrhus and some other famous, celebrated military generals. And I think that's sort of the irony. As we got to the shallower parts of the river, there weren't really any famous names, right? There wasn't anybody really worth remembering. The end of this canto, he's going to mention a couple of obscure bandits in the area of Florence. Those will be the sort of lesser, not that violent souls. But the irony is that although men like Attila and Pyrrhus and Alexander the Great, for that matter, and even Achilles, we learn about them in school, they're the admired figures of history. Even if we disapprove of them, we still think of them as very important. The irony here is that they're actually less fortunate than the obscure souls, because bandits like these two guys that are going to end the canto, you know, they're doing this to themselves for a few souls, right? They're gripping for dear life, dear afterlife, onto two or three or four acts of violence. But Attila's eternal fate is to never repent of even one of the killings that he committed. And in this way, he actually suffers far more than any of the others because he's locked into those violent acts all multiplied together at once. It's as though, let's say you killed 1,000 people. It's as though you could have your soul in the state that it was when you killed all 1,000 of them all at once, and that moment is prolonged for all eternity.
And Renier de Corneto and Renier Pazzo, who made upon the highway so much war. Then back he turned and passed again the ford.
Okay, I have a burning question.
Okay.
How is this different from the Circle of Wrath?
Well, that's an excellent question. So if we think back to the Circle of Wrath, we recall that the souls there spent their eternity in a sort of river of muck, and they were just punching each other for all eternity. It was sort of an eternal brawl. Now, you might think, well, I mean, wrath, violence, this seems like it's kind of the same thing. Did Dante run out of ideas, and is he just doubling up? So there is actually a pretty important distinction. So in the Circle of Wrath, what those souls are after is, you can conceive of it two ways. One way is to see that what they take to be their highest good is that feeling, the passion of anger. They just go wherever that passion takes them. Now, of course, you shouldn't do that. That's bad. They're in hell. But there's a larger nugget of goodness there, because sometimes anger is a good thing. It's not always an immoral thing. It's a human emotion. And in this way, it's kind of all right.
It's what you do about.
So what you do about it. And then the second way to understand them is that what they're sort of after is conflict, right? It might be that they're, as we talked about, the equivalent of the person who delights a little too much in getting into arguments on Twitter with people, right? in that, like, it's the conflict that they enjoy. And that's the sort of the thrill that comes from that they're after. Now, if we compare this to the Circle of Violence, think of some of the figures that we had here. Attila the Hun was not getting back at people who'd personally wronged him. He was not acting out based on a passion. He was actively, willingly wanting people to die. And that's the difference in the Circle of Violence. What's happening here is that these souls, the harm isn't secondary. It's not, I feel this way, and if I harm someone, I will feel better, or I will enjoy it, or there will be a perverse pleasure with it. It's rather
not getting a release or a joy from the harming.
Yeah, or the way you might see it is that it's the Circle of Wrath. You know, a wrathful person might choose to kill someone, but it's sort of secondary, right? The feeling is what they're worshiping, and they're just going wherever the feeling takes them. Mm-hmm. But here, it's almost the reverse. If there is anger in the moment of murder, that's only sought here because it helps you commit murder more effectively. What you're really after is the kill. That's the thing that you're chasing for all eternity.
It's revenge.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Okay. So think of, I guess if you want, think of the experience of the wrathful is to just feeling the thrill, the intensity of your anger for all eternity. Think of the experience of the violent as expanding the moment of the murder for all eternity. So what you were doing, thinking, and willing in the moment when your hands were around the neck, that's your eternity.
It's almost like they would... Ooh, that was a loud car.
Yeah.
It's like they're choosing that above all.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't trade it for anything because there's something about that having done that that has, I guess, in their twisted minds,
mm-hmm.
set them free or have made them better or has vindicated something.
Yeah, I think that there is certainly a perverse sense of freedom there, that they've chosen to destroy another soul, and that there is a certain power in that. There's a certain... But of course, there's also irony, because this is part of the Dante Daily.
Yeah.
Sin hurts the sinner most of all. A part of what Dante is showing us here with this boiling river of blood is that Attila the Hun is actually more unfortunate than any of his victims. He's actually been harmed more by his violence than any of the people he killed. some of the people he killed might, of course, also have similar eternal fates, but then that would be secondary. It wouldn't be because Attila killed them that they've gone to hell. It would be because of some other thing that they were doing, some other sin.
Okay. So I feel like I think I've got it, but I still feel like every time I say it, you've got more to say, like I've kind of got it wrong. From what I've said so far, am I missing something?
No, I don't think you're missing something, but I guess we should really explain, I think, a bit more what the Dante Daily is. That might help us kind of follow what we're getting at here.
So their soul, obviously, is in danger. They've chosen, you know, violence harms the sinner more than the victim. Yes, okay, if we're talking about a physical violence, the person who has committed that act is not physically hurt because the victim is hurt. But then you're saying that that person's soul, right, their moral standing, their lens on the world, the lens on the crime itself, the violence itself, is wrong. It's not right, which then would lead them kind of, you were talking about, I think you were talking about St. Thomas Aquinas's ratios or the angles. And if you veer off one angle, the further and further away you go.
Yeah,
right? Is that kind of it? Like, because if I think about it that way, then what I have to say is basically the scary, scary thing is that anyone is capable of committing the worst atrocities. This isn't just a special type of person. There definitely are special types of people who have gone so far. And, you know, the things that I think about when I think of this, I think of, yeah, people who've committed murder, people who have harmed others. Like, I'm thinking of the River of Blood, right? I'm thinking of, unfortunately, I hate to say it, mass shootings, things like that. If we're not taking care of ourselves, you know, in the last episode, I mentioned it's really important to do a good examination of conscience. An examination of conscience isn't any good if you don't have a grasp on morality.
I really like what you said there about the degrees of separation, that even if you've chosen something that's, you know, a little far from God, if you pursue it forever, you still get eternally far away from God, even though you might say, oh, but that other guy in the lower circle, the thing he picked is nowhere near God. But you're still running away from God forever. We've talked about hell being a funnel. Now, the souls actually in hell cannot slide down further into the funnel. Once they've got their circle, they stay there. But what you're noting is really the key point of that funnel image for us, for the living. Because when you're alive, you can get worse. So if you hang out in the circle of wrath for a while, you don't necessarily stay there. You do very easily slip from, I just will do anything this feeling tells me, to, I will harm people even when the feeling isn't telling me to, right? And that's, it isn't actually that rare for people to go there. It's almost just a matter of time, right? The longer you are in one part of the funnel, well, it's like that ball spinning around, like you mentioned in one of our previous shows, right? Eventually, you do get down to the bottom.
Right. And this is what I mean when I talk about that. The reason why I'm pushing this a little bit more and have mentioned it twice is because someone doesn't just wake up one day saying they want to kill someone or they're going to do something crazy. This has stewed for a while. Something has driven them to violence. Things that happen quickly, you tend to regret because there wasn't a lot of thought put into this. But this sounds like this was something that would have been really, what do you call it? Preconceived.
Yeah, definitely. So premeditated and so on.
Premeditated.
And I think that's really the point of the image of the River of Blood. Like, the reason that people with more murders are deeper in the blood, it's not just like a numerical where you have more crimes, so you deserve a worse punishment.
It's their attachment to that crime.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
It's like it's bad enough to spend all of your eternity not repenting for one murder and to be continually choosing that murder for all eternity. But let's suppose you are continually choosing for all eternity 700 murders. That's what the depths of blood really mean.
I can see very much how violence harms the sinner more than the victim. especially if there's a great attachment to the crime more than the consequence. Earlier you had mentioned that the song that would be appropriate for this is from Chicago.
Yes.
The musical.
Mm-hmm.
And it's He Had It Coming.
Yes.
Or
so,
is it whatever the title is. I don't know.
I think it's called like the Cell Block Tango.
Oh, but, the Cell Block Tango, yes.
But people will know it as He Had It Coming. Because okay. that's the line that gets,
that gets repeated
actually
over
stuck
and over
in your head. Yeah.
Okay. Would you say that that's the perfect song for it because of how these women are already in jail? And they're saying he had it coming. It's like, and many of these ladies are just literally on the cell block waiting for their execution.
Yeah, to me, what is really perfect about that song for this canto is, you know, for a popular song, a surprisingly subtle artistic choice. So the song starts with the various murderers, as we discover. Mm-hmm. Just repeating over and over again these sort of nonsensical words like
pop,
squish, Cicero.
And it doesn't. Something, Lipschitz.
Yeah. And when you first hear it, you're like, well, what's that?
Yeah.
But then as you hear each of their stories, you discover that the word they're repeating is like a central word in the moment of the murder.
Goodness.
So what it actually, I don't know if I don't know if the people who wrote the song are big Dante fans. It wouldn't surprise me, because what they're actually conceiving is
over
that they're sitting in the prison reliving the murder over and over again, and not
so happy to tell it.
And that's
they're
what's
happy to tell
that's
it.
That's what's disturbing about it. They're not reliving it the way, say, Lady Macbeth does, where she's reliving it but wishes she hadn't done it.
Yeah.
They're reliving it, and although it's not making them happy, they're loving every minute of that reliving it.
Yeah, he had it coming, as they say over and over again. Okay, so that is a very good song.
Yes, I would say so.
For this.
Before we dive into that song, there is one point that we should probably make. So the Dante Daily is on purpose not specifically about violence. It says sin harms the sinner most of all. Now, that obviously applies to very serious violent acts like this, but it actually applies to any sin that harms another person. That when you commit a mortal sin, you are literally, in Catholic theology, killing your soul in that moment. And that doesn't just mean, well, there's an unpleasant consequence to come later on. It means something awful is happening to you right then, right in that moment, even if you get away with whatever it might be, spreading that nasty rumor that you know isn't true, ripping that other guy off in the business deal. So for our own normal examinations of conscience, for our own normal spiritual life, we've got to actually take that seriously. That, my gosh, when I deliberately do something that I know is seriously wrong, that's worse than stepping into traffic, right? That's worse than putting my hands on the hot stove. Because the harm that those things cause might be very serious, but it's just harm to the body at the end of the day. Mm. But this harm could imperil my eternal fate. And that really is the question that those of us who are not like the women in the Chicago song can take to our ordinary spiritual lives. Because maybe, I think very few of us are tempted to mortal sins in the form of, you know, murder. But all of us are tempted to some kind of mortal sin, right? Like that's part of living the spiritual life. There's some death of the soul that the devil dangles in front of us, and we won't really safely refuse it unless we keep this in mind, right? That it is a spiritual death to do this thing. It's true. God is so merciful that there's confession, that he can bring those dead souls back to life. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that in the moment of doing it, you're not killing your soul.
Right. There are so many different types of violence. And when you think of violence harming the sinner more than the victim, I think of precisely what you're saying, that there the danger of the soul. Essentially, that's really the biggest point, the danger of the soul. It also makes me think of, you know, in the occasions, and now you can think of all different cases, and we're going to be hitting on basically moral theology now, deep moral theology, and the different cases that could be played out, and one of them being, well, essentially someone dying by suicide. You know, would that person then be culpable? And also, well, essentially, Well, there's so much, right? Mm-hmm. There's so much I could talk about. There's so much I could expand on, but I feel like there has to be a special ring for that.
Well, it's good that you brought that up. Yeah, in the next... So we're going to stay in the Circle of Violence for a few cantos, because it's got subsections. The next subsection is going to be the violent against self. And one thing that we'll talk about in that canto is, okay, but then what about the spiritual state of, you know, not poem characters, real people who do this? What is the church teaching? And I think one thing, even for this canto, to keep in mind, you may have noticed that Dante is not that interested, at least in the Inferno. He will be later. He's not that interested in venial sinners as such. The cases he profiles are people that are, shall we say, at peace with their sins. That's perhaps not a good phrase, but right. We might notice that all the people that we've profiled, because he really wants to teach us about what these sins are.
They prefer their sins.
Mm-hmm. So for him, the best way to teach you about what are you really doing when you commit serious violence against another, for him, you need people that are doing it without reservation. If you have someone who just did it but didn't really mean to do it and wishes they hadn't and so forth, it's not that those people are uninteresting, but it's that they don't help him make the poetic and theological points he wants to make. When we get into purgatory, we'll certainly see more of that struggle and the half-willed sins and things like that. But in the Inferno, we're usually going to see souls that are not all that reluctant about what they're doing. But the key point is that one of the main things in Catholic theology is that for a sin to be mortal, it does have to be fully willed all the way. And as you've noted, when in the case of suicide, part of the conversation is how many of these are really, shall we say, premeditated in the full sense of this term, that it's of sound mind, I'm really thinking it all the way through, I totally understand, there's no reservations, and that sort of thing. One thing we'll see in this next canto is that medievals just figured that if people did this, they must have only done it with full consent of the will. And it's worth talking about why they thought that, but that will help us understand what's happening in the next canto with Dante.
Okay. Well, let's listen to some ignorant women singing about
yes, indeed.
The murder of, well, the committing of murder of their own husbands. Here we go. So it's catchy.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to note right off the bat, because I know that we've got parents with children, this song is not appropriate for your children to listen to all the way through. Get as far as maybe the first chorus.
That's true. Cell Block Tango.
Six. Squish. Cicero.
Lipschitz.
Squish.
Cicero.
Lipschitz.
Squish.
Cicero.
Lipschitz.
Thanks for listening to the CamCam Books podcast. Follow us on Instagram at CamCam Books.